down to earth in the bottom of the earth of Gautama Buddha to the advent of the Maitreya Buddha. The Bodhisattvas cannot in any way alter their courses of action. Above and beyond the Bodhisattva is the final state recognized in Buddhism, and that is the state of the Buddha. If we go back now to the historical life of Gautama, we find that this life is divided into two distinct patterns. In one of these patterns, we find the meditating mystic, the truth seeker, the one who fasted and prayed and came very close to death, who finally achieved illumination at Buddha Gaya. He then went forth on a spiritual ministry that lasted for nearly 50 years. In this ministry, we find him teaching, meditating, praying, discoursing with his disciples, seeking to share with them the Dharma and the Sangha, or the law and the morals. This very largely represents the concept of the Theravada school of Southern Buddhism, the teacher, the arhat approaching the final liberation. But in the records and in the books, even in the Dhammapada, and of course in substance, in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, we find Buddha emerging with a different personality. This is the personality of the servant. We find Buddha wandering around, helping the sick, caring for the aged, listening to the complaints of contendants in court, trying to arbitrate the disputes of princes over lands and goods, trying to help people bring up and properly educate their children, outperforming innumerable common services as an unselfish humanitarian, walking for miles along the roads, living under the stars, forever available to those in need, receiving disciples and instructing them, and at the same time sharing with all the common hardships of the pilgrim. This is the Mahayana phase of the Buddha nature. So in Mahayana, we have a different concept, even of the Buddha being. He is no longer the one who simply retires into oblivion. Although it is not at all certain that Buddha himself actually taught nirvana as annihilation of individuality. He simply refused to discuss it. But in the northern system, we find the emergence of the great metaphysical Buddhas, who in turn had arisen from the order of the Bodhisattvas. And these metaphysical Buddhas were ones such as Amida, or Amitabha, Lord of the Western Paradise, who, having completed his vow of service, has fashioned a region to receive into itself all those with whom he served and labored, so that they would go forth with him into everlasting peace. This concept of the Mahayana Buddha, the metaphysical Buddha, is the concept set forth in the Sutra of the Lotus of the Good Law. Here space is filled with an infinitude of these radiant, self-achieved beings, who by their own merits have risen from the lowest grains of sand, and by ages of dedication have come finally to be the benevolent protectors of those growing up around them as their children and their disciples. So that the Mahayana transforms this whole pattern into a wonderful, benevolent family relationship. Now these two patterns, space filled with the gods of Hinduism, space resplendent with the Buddhas of Northern Buddhism, a space in either case, a vast friendliness filled with potential life, with Buddhism somewhat more democratic in its approach. For in Hinduism, the heavy boundaries of the caste system still have their weight. But in the Northern school of Buddhism, everyone, every being, regardless of estate, every creature, male and female, every animal, bird, insect, had within itself the potential and the equal right to eternal illumination and eternal peace. This difference, however, did not skimp the astronomy of the Buddhist theory. It simply gave a new kind of being authority. It caused the law to operate through creatures produced by itself, rather than by creatures arbitrarily set up over it. Instead of the deities arising primarily from the mind of the infinite, the deities arose primarily from creation itself according to laws in the mind of the infinite. And the universe was transformed into a great process of growth, an infinite unfoldment of the Buddha seed, the Bija, as it was called, the seed that is everywhere and in everything, the seed that is symbolized by the beautiful pagoda and the relic contained within it. This infinite growth of things upward resulted in a series of beliefs and attitudes which occur in both Hinduism and in Buddhism, but with a different basic perspective due to the variance in the theory itself. The Hindu system developed a series of teachers suspended from the Supreme Being, Shiva, as the Mahaguru, as the great teacher of all things. In this sense, the educational system was established as a certainty, as a fact, as a reality, and the teachers of it were instructed by their teachers, and these in turn by still higher teachers, until at the source of all things was the great teacher, Shiva. Here we have a dogmatism descending, a concept that all truths were established in a descent of teaching, and that these truths reach this planet from other worlds, and that the great cluster of the esoteric order of our solar system occupied the mysterious Gobina in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia, and that of the whole solar system was polarized in the constellation of the Bear, the Great Bear, or the Rishi, the stars of the immortal teachers. It follows, therefore, that in Hinduism, man moves step by step along a path that had been clearly set for him by divinity. And that the great virtue rested in the unconditioned acceptance of this, and the continual acceptance of the instruction of the Guru. And that this instruction demanded the absolute loyalty of the disciple. Because the Guru was, by a kind of apostolic succession, descended from truth itself. The Guru system, therefore, was a great structure of spiritual education, which at one time, of course, also included education in practically all secular matters. The Buddhist system was essentially not too different, but there was one very curious difference, which in a way altered the whole picture, more than we have any realization about until we begin the actual study of the yoga and of the tantra. This is that the great schools arose not from mysterious superhuman beings, messengers or avatars of deity, but the great schools, like man himself, evolve upward out of the darkness of ignorance, and may therefore properly be represented by the open blossom of the blue lotus, which, having sent its stem up through the mud and the water, finally opens its immaculate blossom upon the surface and adores the sun. Thus, in Buddhism, the great schools, so called, are really created by enlightened, illumined human beings. These schools have no significance, no meaning, and no purpose outside of humanity. The symbolism is only valid because man is the creature that he is. They are fashioned from human necessity and not by divine dictatorship. In substance, their instruction is not very different. But the disciple or student is always reminded that the final unfoldment of knowledge is a voluntary action of his own. But it is the release of truth in himself that constitutes achievement. Truth is not bestowed by any power. Truth is innate and is released by aspiration, dedication, and discipline. Thus the Buddha seed is the reason why man can know. It is because he possesses within himself the archetypal form by which Buddhahood can be attained. Now, the Buddha, as we found in several of the sects, the Buddha is again only a word. The Buddha represents Bodhi, or enlightenment, in terms of human achievement. No man, no Buddha is one of the old axioms, and Zen has made a great deal of it. Actually, the Buddha is a symbol of what man, as man, can accomplish in himself, of himself, and by himself, through personal dedication and collective effort. He represents, therefore, what may reasonably be expected of man. And in no sense of the word does Buddha represent any extraordinary power bestowed by any deity upon anyone. nor does it represent an embodiment of a deity in any way different than the deity indwelling in all and equally embodied in everything that lives. This is not a denial of deity, but it is the denial of an extraordinary process by which some can attain, by virtue of a different code of conduct than that required of mankind in general. It then actually means that the term Theta was applied anciently to an historical person that gradually came to represent the archetypal human being in the first development of his humanity. We have exactly the same process of transformation taking place in the New Testament, where Jesus, the human teacher, is gradually identified with the Christos, the universal mystery of life. And it was Paul who transformed a Syrian sect into a world religion. It is in the same way that Mormon Buddhism transformed a sect that was practically extinct in India into one of the most powerful forces in the moral history of Asia. This transformation was achieved by one circumstance of basically, namely that Buddha represented nothing extraordinary, nothing miraculous, nothing utterly wonderful, only the natural virtue of man given an opportunity to express itself through right dedication to the great labors of human redemption. In this sense, therefore, the esoteric schools in Buddhism represent, therefore, the grades of schools established by those who have walked the path themselves. Every teacher in Buddhism has a clear and fond memory of his own total ignorance. He is also enabled, much as the Buddha did in the Jataka tales, to describe the incidents of his own previous embodiments, many of which were not commendable, but which represented in their time and under their circumstances the groping of human consciousness for reality. The Buddhist esoteric school, therefore, is tied to the pattern of experience rather than the pattern of revelation. It represents man working out a way for his own salvation. And achieving this path through the gradual exploration of the world by such sensory and other perceptions as he may possess. These perceptions dedicated to their highest and most proper use. Because of its position, of course, Buddhism also eliminates many of the products which most come from a revelational system, or one based upon acceptance or rejection of divine edicts. In Buddhism, for example, there can be no true concept of hell. There are in various Buddhist systems stories about heaven and hell, and all the mysterious regions where individuals suffer punishments for their mistakes. The sixth region view is well known in Tibetan Lamaism, a form of Buddhism. But even as the Buddhist tells you the story, he smiles and reminds you that heaven and hell are merely attitudes of your own mind. But if you live in the face of a bad conscience, you are certainly going to be punished. that wherever the mind attaches itself to illusion, it must suffer. And if a person over a number of lives attaches himself to delusions, he must have a long and difficult course of rescue. For the simple reason that he must rescue himself, and perhaps has lost all interest in so doing. The problem of how to rescue a person who does not know he is lost without someone helping him becomes a rather difficult problem. But the ancient law is equal to this emergency and all others. The individual who is wrong, be it for 50 lives or 100 lives, who is convinced of the correctness of his error, must sometime be brought back into line by suffering. He cannot continue indefinitely and eternally to make mistakes that hurt him. And gradually, if his nature deteriorates, these mistakes become more frequent and more irrational and more obviously false. And finally, they become sufficiently simple, sufficiently obvious, and sufficiently uncomfortable to force their recognition. This is the only way in which nature actually intervenes in the process of enlightenment. This is all that is necessary. For the moment man knows that certain courses of action lead to suffering, and certain other courses of action lead to serenity and peace, he is already in possession of the key to his own salvation. So these two schools develop together to produce a great transphysical philosophy. Man of Brahmanism, Hinduism, or Hinduism would like to be called metaphysical. And neither, finally, would Buddhism. We may call them metaphysical or mystical movements, but they prefer to think of themselves as perfectly orderly rationalizations by scientific means of the science of human regeneration. They prefer to be regarded simply as a lawful way out of the confusion, mystery, and maze of human life. The only answers to those problems which commonly burden all of us. Madame Blavatsky, taking these two systems and several others, did something which has always been completely permissible in nature, but has nearly always led to a horrible situation when it was attempted in the Western world. Namely, Madame Blavatsky followed the processes of the old gurus and arhats of ages. She brought the elements together in a new arrangement. As far as I can see, she combined these two systems to create a structure which she regarded as suitable to the needs of people of the 20th and 19th centuries. She fully realized that many aspects of Oriental philosophy could not be applied after the passing of thousands of years to the conditions of modern people. Also, that prejudices and opinions were such that it was very important to strip these older beliefs of any associations which might damage their acceptance. After all, the gods are not proud. There is no particular reward in nature for orthodoxy. The only people who really appreciate it are the orthodox people themselves. For the rest, it has no valid significance. The new schools of Indian philosophy arose over a long period of time. There were many splinter groups. Most of them were respected. Each one was regarded as a perfectly reasonable development to meet the needs of people with special requirements. Thus, long before the advent of Buddha, there have been many systems of philosophy set up in Asia. These systems, of course, reveal one thing that we cannot fail to notice, namely that even in India in that time, while certain immense facts were known, India was still captured in the web of its own realization, namely that creation as we know it is a mental entity, therefore incapable of identification with absolute truth itself, only in some conditioned way. This man's searching for truth, instead of being dogmatic and insisting that one has it and no one else can have it, in India from the early time it was assumed that truth would probably ultimately be realized as the sum of all honorable seeking, that each individual discovering some fragment of a new knowledge or a more advanced knowledge was thereby contributing to the ultimate revelation of one religion. Religions were therefore in Hinduism inescapably one, regardless of how many sects were set up. Sectarianism was merely a manifestation of the absolute unity of truth. The Buddhist held almost exactly the same point of view on this. He was never greatly disturbed over the rise of new schools. And in the northern system, in the Mahayana, there were many new schools. Many patriarchs wrote important commentaries upon the ancient sutras. Even actual sacred books were written long after the death of Buddha and attributed to him, or rather to the consciousness of him, operating in the lives of the patriarchs, abbots, saints, and leaders, mahats of the faith. There was no concept of the idea that the day of revelation was dated. Revelation came to the individual only, and it could come to him in early day or late day. It made no difference. It was his own merit. And having received this revelation, he was perfectly justified in teaching it. And this was the policy in Japan. And the sects of Japanese Buddhism that exist today that either derived from Chinese schools that were brought to Japan, or else were indigenous and developed within Japanese life itself as a necessary means of interpreting a foreign religion. So if Madame Blavatsky followed the ancient order, he would feel perfect freedom in rearranging certain patterns to produce what she would regard as an appropriate dispensation. In this, it is believed or traditionally held that she was assisted by certain adepts who were of other or different religions. One of them, by name, obviously a Buddhist, another a Hindu, one a Eurasian, and another a European. These various leaders unfolded spiritual centers of life, whereby were perfectly justified in reshaping and restating the Western people certain essential, usable, practical principles of Eastern esotericism. This apparently is what was accomplished. I have thought this matter over with both Orthodox Hindus and Orthodox Buddhists. Most of them are quite convinced that the message which Madame Blavatsky brought was entirely legitimate. They are also convinced, however, that it is not identical either with Hinduism or Buddhism as these are exoterically practiced today. She did not claim that they were. She claimed, rather, to have derived her information from certain secret sources and old foundations, by the means of which she sought to circumscribe or in one way or another modify the later teachings, which probably would have been a little too controversial for acceptance by non-Oriental people. As a result of that, what she accomplished is broadly acceptable to both Hindus and Buddhists. It is also viewed with considerable admiration and respect by Parsis, by Muslims, Sufis, and other various groups. Of course, this acceptance depends to a great degree upon the basic attitudes of the groups themselves. But actually, in the Sutra doctrine, there are streams of information which belong to all of these groups, and which for the most part have been neglected by them. Therefore, the general feeling that arises in connection with this revelation is that it is a restoration of all times, of all things that have been forgotten, even by the Orthodox members of living religions. Yet when brought to their attention, they remember that there were vestiges, references, intimations that such things actually existed long ago. That there were such truths that were broadly available, but which had been lost, so to say, in the rise of creedal and denominational religions. Thus, the Sutra doctrine seeks to break through these boundaries. And one of its essential purposes is to point out that so far as we know today, that part of Eastern wisdom which is now incorporated in the Vedas, the Institutes of Mani, the Vishnu Purana, and the Zen Avestas, and the original basket books of Pali Buddhism, that these elements together constitute a reasonable summation of what may be termed the original basic religion of mankind. That at a remote time, even in this world in which we live, there was a common spiritual heritage. We have discovered in recent years, for example, what looks as though it is going to be a key to the basic language of mankind. And we have long believed that there were a number of root languages which were separate and for which there could be found no reasonable common denominator. We are now convinced that all languages of mankind, even those of primitive people, have one origin, have a common source in a primordial language. In the same way, it is conceivable and now held that what we now know as the light of the Veda, or the light of the law, not necessarily referring now simply to Hindu law, but the light of the great law of things. And the great law was revealed to the Institutes of Mani, represent the primordial religion of mankind. That this religion developed either in the valley of the Indus or perhaps in the great trans Asian area involving and bridging from Persia to China, that somewhere in this vast area, the first major spiritual revelation of religion came to man, or man experienced it. It is very probable that he experienced it. It was the dawn of his own discoveries of self. And this experience revealed through him and to him began the process of enlightening him and establishing him upon a path of spiritual growth. Though we also realize that today, and as far as that is concerned, we can go back to 2,500 years ago, and realize that the reforms of Buddha, and also the great revelations of Zoroaster, Confucius, Lao Tzu, and other teachers of the time, had their roots in still earlier religions, just as Judaism had its roots in Babylonian and Syrian faiths which preceded it, and Christianity was heavily embedded to the Mosaic Law. Modernism, in turn, was a combination of Orientalism, Christianity, and Judaism. So, therefore, we have to assume that in the human experience of things, knowledge is first perpetuated by descent, that the first knowledge is always of the outer nature of things, and that only the mystics or esotericists arise within the structure of a religion does its inner meaning become apparent. And this inner meaning is nothing more or less than the Buddhist lotus rising out of the darkness and blossoming, for it is man's own light coming of age through him and using his former doctrines as a symbolical catalyzing agent. So it is also held that in the very beginning of things, long before we knew anything on this planet about these matters, that it is essential that a tradition of some kind must have reached this planet, either from previous cycles of life, from the higher invisible planes of this planet, or from some source other than that of the evolving human being who is still trying to make the bridge between an anthropoidal and a human existence. So in nearly all religions, there are references to these ancient revelations. And the question as to how they came, where they came from, and what they were always be intriguing. One viewpoint, of course, is that graduates from previous life waves could well have been the source of this instruction, because it is foolish to assume that we are the only class that ever hopes to graduate from the university of existence. Another pattern is that these revelations were placed here in anticipation by beings who were to become incarnate here. After they became incarnate, their inner faculties would have been so obscured that they could no longer have remembered. To cover this point, they bestowed their knowledge upon institutions or groups in the world, so that when they later took on bodies, their own knowledge would be available to them and would come to them as though from another person. All of these patterns can be variously interpreted, but it was held, of course, by nearly all the ancient peoples that in some way the great descent of the esoteric wisdom was a valid unfoldment here in this environment of an eternal tradition. That this eternal tradition actually was built around a contemplation and comprehension of the plane of consciousness for existence. That it descended in various ways, through those of different degrees of insight. The ancients never claimed that even the highest of the esoteric schools was perfect, but it did represent that which man had been able to know, to learn, and to understand concerning the infinite plan for things. This school, or these schools, which were groups now generally referred to as the Sangha in Buddhism, the Brotherhood, was composed of all who had attained transcendent enlightenment. All who possessed greater knowledge formed a faculty, for the initiation of those possessing lesser knowledge. Such was the way in which the mystery schools of Greece and Egypt and other ancient nations came into existence. The initiators had themselves received the enlightenment, but most of all, they had received the disciplines by means of which they could unfold their own inner powers to the degree that they could comprehend as personal experience certain extensions of mental and spiritual insight. It was therefore assumed, either by the Buddhists or by the Hindus, that the only valid source of knowledge had to be the awakened faculties and powers of the individual. These powers and these faculties would lead him to what the ancients called the lesser mysteries. They would lead him up to the point where the mind fulfilled its own destiny. They would take him as near to truth as man could bring him, and would give him, therefore, a complete rationalization of the purposes of existence as man himself can know them or can learn them, either by theory or practice. So that finally the individual comes to the circumference of the universe of mind. And here he stands, so to say, or sits, as according to the Buddhist philosophy, on what is called the threshold of vacuity. He goes as far as he can go. One step further, and he can never again capture even his own mentality. One step further, and he must go into a superior state of existence, which he cannot estimate, and which from this side of the veil appears to be nothing. It appears to be a vacuum, an absolute blank. That is the reason why it was called vacuity in the old writings. But we are now in a position to be very doubtful about the whole problem of vacuity. For we have suddenly discovered what we always affirm, namely that nature abhors vacuum. We have no reason to believe that vacuum exists. We can produce certain types of artificial vacuum in a laboratory, but we're not even sure that that is a true vacuum. What we really are beginning to suspect is that what we know as the unknown is actually the fullness of all things worth knowing. The consciousness itself, with all its magnificent equipment, lies in this thing that we call vacuum. In any event, mind, having achieved its highest degree of attainment, is expressed in the Seven School by the Arhat in Buddhism, who has brought the mind under perfect discipline and can renounce it without a moment's hesitation, perfectly willing to exchange mind for vacuum, if such is the fact, but deeply convinced that there is something beyond vacuum. In the modern system, we have the Bodhisattva, who, having reached the boundaries of this mysterious realm, must either return and serve, and must continue on to the final state of existence, which is described by the old Buddhist poem that has the line in it, "Gone, gone, gone to the other shore." The end of this condition that we know, that which steps through never returns. And this stepping through is an infinitely more momentous thing than the very simple and comparatively unimportant process of stepping through the gate of death into that which lies beyond. But this Bodhisattva state is as far as the individual can go and retain self-awareness and be aware of existence as an intellectual entity in relation to other entities. Whatever lies beyond must be if he's a northern Buddhist, Nirvana, to the southern Buddhist, some mysterious abode of infinite peace, and to the Hindu, the attainment and identity with Atman through the process of the final samadhi. These different processes all represent the step from the lesser mysteries to the greater. The step from conditioned knowledge, still largely infiltrated with ignorance, to infinite unconditioned knowledge, which is actual participation in the consciousness of eternity itself. There is elaborate machinery, so-called, is actually very simple in substance. For each individual, where he is, can make this step. He must make it himself. He can receive some help, some guidance, some instruction, but it is only through the discipline of his own consciousness, the regeneration of his own nature, the purification of his own thoughts and emotions, that this transition can actually be made, and no one can make it for him, nor can they practice virtues for him. He must achieve his own. Out of this concept, then, was developed a philosophy of Eastern thinking which brings together the vast background of belief, tradition, universal attitude, everything necessary to strongly defend and support this primitive, eternal path of salvation. Madame Blavatsky brought this material together in the secret doctrine in the hope that the weight of this evidence, the mass of it, and the integrity of its basic concept would assure it reasonable recognition by truth seekers in all parts of the world. And while the work has never as yet received the full recognition to which it is entitled, and certainly the greatest compilation of such material that has ever been made, it is still only fair to say that with the passing of time, interest has increased rather than decreased, and more the advancements of our common knowledge are revealing to us the accuracy of the esoteric tradition. And sometimes, based upon this continuing experience, we may open our eyes sufficiently to have some concept, some understanding, some insight of the magnificent universe in which we live and the wonderful destiny for which we were created. When we begin to think in this way, most of the common problems of our daily living will automatically solve themselves. Well, time is up, so that's all we can do for this evening.